Hi, I'm Mike Nagrett, and you're listening to Hunger Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hey there, I hope the holidays are treating you well. This is like my 28th podcast since I started doing this last January. And recently I went back and listened to some of the early interviews, and I realized it was all serious and whispering into my intros, and I sounded like I was broadcasting live from a bunker in a war zone. It was definitely odd for me, but, you know, I've been watching Rachel Ray a lot, and I've been studying up. So I hope to bring you a lot more personality next year. Now, seriously, though, I do hope to bring you a lot of great interviews in 2007, but right now, here's a little holiday treat to end 2006. Mahdur Joffrey is a Renaissance woman, an actress, a writer, and a cook. Born in Delhi, India, she moved to the UK to study acting. While there, she pined for an authentic home-cooked Indian meal. But while growing up, she never actually really cooked. So she wrote her mother asking for cooking advice and recipes. The letters they exchanged launched a ship that now constitutes hundreds of articles, many critically acclaimed cookbooks, and a few cooking shows. Joffrey has a new memoir out called Climbing the Mango Trees about her childhood in India. It's a rich and vivid romp of the senses, and last week while she was in Chicago, we caught up via a phone call. Also, Joffrey and I discussed James Ivory and Ishmael Merchant in this interview. If you don't recognize their names, you surely know their work. They're the legendary production team behind literary-based period pieces like Jefferson in Paris, The Remains of the Day, Howard's End, A Room with a View, and so many more. Please enjoy the interview. Well, good morning. Welcome to Chicago.
Good morning. It's wonderful to be here and such a warm day.
One of my first cookbooks was actually an invitation to Indian cooking.
Wow.
It's one of the first ones I bought probably like 10 years ago when I first really got into cooking. You know, one of the things I remember from the introduction, I know you talked about not being particularly or not really cooking while you were growing up. And the first.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, the first sort of thing was you while you were in the UK, you wrote letters to your mother on the recipes. And I wondered what those letters were like. And I wondered, you know, were they just about food or, you know, I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit.
Well, you know, I still have them. And they are always on flimsy, either they're air letters, which you don't even have anymore, or they're on flimsy paper to go by air, so they would be as light as possible. My mother always wrote with a fountain pen and ink. She didn't know any English, and so she wrote in Hindi. And they always started very formally, and they were full of family, because, you know, we knew anything about was the family. So they were full of family information, like where we are going for the holidays, we are shopping for shawls, and we went to Kashmir, and we went on a holiday, and I bought a shawl for so-and-so, and so-and-so is engaged to be married, and he's married marrying this very nice girl with green eyes. And, you know, it was full of stuff like that. And then there'd be a paragraph or two with recipes. He says, I know you want to know how to cook this and that. This is how you make it. And the recipes were like 5 lines. You take this and put ginger in it, and then you put cumin in this, and you cook it for a little bit, and then you add a little water and put the lid on and just let it cook till it's done. So they were like that. But they gave me the clues that I needed. And since I remember the taste, actually, they just gave me the clues that I needed to get going.
Yeah, and I read or I've heard that you relied a lot on your taste and your sense of what you grew up with, and I thought
that
was interesting, because it probably makes you a better cook, because you're relying on your senses. I think so many people rely on recipes nowadays, and if you use
your different, I'm now convinced really that there is a palate, and that as people have good ears and perfect pitch, there are people who have like a perfect pitch in their palates, and they don't always necessarily know they have it. They just start cooking and it all works out for them quite well. And I think that comes from, if you have perfect pitch and you can hear well, you retain it. Whatever you've eaten is then recorded, because you've understood it so thoroughly that you record it completely. And then you're able, in a way, to bring it up again when you need it. And I know that in my particular case, and I don't think it's something I've developed, I think it's just something I've had, if I'm shopping and I see green beans that look very good, I will mentally say, okay, I can cook them with mustard seeds and garlic, and I know what they're going to taste like. Mm-hmm. Or I can make them the French way with a little butter, a little maybe mustard, French mustard, and then I know what they're going to taste like. So the tastes have all been recorded and can be combined in ways that you can do if you're a musician as well. You can create music in your head. And I think people who have a good palate can create food in their heads and be tasting it even before they've cooked it.
Yeah, it reminds me of, you know, you hear about composers who are deaf, but they can still write symphonies because they know how the music sounds in their head.
Exactly. And I think this is just something you're born with.
You know, this brings up the idea of taste memory, and I know you've been talking about that a lot, and I know in your new memoir, it's so rich, you know, with the sights and the sounds and the smells and tastes, of course. And I wondered, you know, because you're writing about a period of many years ago, that, you know, did you find yourself cooking the dishes or trying to recreate those, or did you just rely entirely on the sense memory, or did you try to jog your sense memory with maybe some of the things that you had while you were a child?
Well, I had to jog it, and I think I mentioned in the book or in some other place, certainly I've written about it, that there was a meat dish that we used to get that my Muslim friends used to bring to school, and I could never get that taste, never. And I kept trying this, I kept trying that. So I remember the taste, but I didn't know how to get there. So that I had to experiment, and I had to get help from people who would give me this idea or that idea. And then eventually I put it all together and did begin to understand why you can have that slightly different flavor that seems a very Muslim flavor as opposed to a Hindu flavor.
Yeah, I wondered about that because there was a passage in your book and you talked about going to school and you know, you were surrounded. You would have Hindi and you would have Muslim and all these different folks around you, and they would bring the same dish, but the dishes would still be, you could tell where they came from or what the provenance was, and I wondered what that essence was, you know, between, say, the Hindu and the Muslim versions of the same dish.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it is a very, very fine line. It's sometimes hard to, it's a combination of things, and you very often can't quite place it. And you don't know what it is. And I still find it very difficult. It's an essence of something. And I remember being in Pakistan and watching. I said, I'm just going to stand here for hours and hours and watch this woman cook, who was cooking for the family. And everything she did slightly differently, starting with the coriander, which she didn't grind on a grinding stone. She mashed it with a mortar and pestle and mashed it very coarsely. So starting from there, everything is just slightly different.
Yeah, so it's those subtle variations that make the difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the introduction to Invitation to Indian Cooking, one of the other things you said, and, you know, obviously this is back in 1973, but, you know, people would ask you if there were good places, good Indian restaurants, and you said that you always, you know, one of the reasons you wrote the book was that, you know, Indian home cooking was the only real example of what you would get back in India, or the richness of...
I would still say that, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I wondered. I wondered if after all these years with the waves of immigration, if that had changed at all.
It's not really, because if you want good quality, well-made, what I call clean Indian food, not muddied by getting all mixed up, even regionally getting mixed up, just being pure to a region, then you have to cook it yourself. There is no other way to get there. Because I think what restaurants do very often, though they try, I mean, I know a lot of restaurants that are now, Indian restaurants that are now trying to sell regional Indian dishes, but they very often muddy them up. And very often a cook doesn't really understand the local specialties. And those local specialties is what makes Indian food great. And I think when people cook at home, they don't make it overly rich. It's cooking for every day. So it's really lightly cooked, lightly, not too much oil in it. And that kind of food you don't get in a restaurant.
Regarding your acting, I think I read that, you know, one of the things you had tried to aspire to, or you said, you know, you kind of wanted the Marlon Brando kind of method acting. You were looking for honesty and truth and intensity in what you were doing. And I wondered if that's the same kind of approach you've taken to food, and maybe you feel if that's why you've been so successful.
I do. I mean, I don't want to be impressed by food. I want to enjoy my food. I think food, we have reasons why we eat. Certainly health and is one of them. But it should please you. It should please you where it hits you, which is on your palate. It should please you there. I don't necessarily want grand places to eat in. I don't necessarily want fancy plates. I think you can cook with very little equipment, very basic equipment, and you can eat off very simple plates. And that, to me, when that is good, nothing else matters. When the food is good, nothing else matters. And yet, I'm not saying that I don't like restaurants that are perfectly designed, because I do. But on the other hand, it's not what I want first. What I want first is that the food be honest and good.
I've come across as a food writer two kinds of people, and there's people who are looking for the honest and good experience, and then there's people who equate the cost of a meal with the quality of the meal. And,
exactly. No, my point was this, that there are all kinds of people, and if your palate is not your primary sense or one of them, then it doesn't matter. Then you can go because you like the looks of a place or because it's expensive. You have other values. But I'm, for example, just off to Sri Lanka to write a piece for Gourmet, and I'm going to go to homes. I'm going to go to little store. I've been already researching all this. Little stalls where they specialize in this, they specialize in that, because that's what will give me a sense of what is best in Sri Lanka.
Mm-hmm.
Not some fancy grand place necessarily, but little individual places that have been cooking something for so many years and they know how to do it.
You know, I was recently at an Indian wedding in Cincinnati, and you know, one of the things I was struck by was how much food there was, you know, and it was how, you know, like you had ladu and you had all these things that, you know, it's completely different, of course, than an American Anglo wedding. And, you know, and just growing up with friends and, you know, going to graduation parties and doing all these things, you know, food seems to be as much a center point of the Indian culture as any culture, you know, and I wondered, you know, if you had a sense of that, if you thought, you know, people always, I think, talk about like the Italians and how they, you know, celebrate with food so much.
It's funny you should say that. It's really funny because the only people I compare us to, in a way, are the Italians. We have very similar approaches to food. It is so central that you don't think about it. It is so central to our daily lives, to every religious festival, to every occasion like a wedding or a birth or death. It's so central to all of these that you don't actually think about it. It just happens. You expect it to happen and it happens. And there are things you cook at funerals, there are things you cook at weddings, there are. And each family has its own list of how they've done it for thousands of years. And they go on doing it that way. And that's what makes it so interesting.
Why do you think that is? Why it is so much more important than maybe, say, it is in the American culture?
Well, you know, old cultures develop their own ways of thought. And certainly in old cultures like India, there's a way of doing things. Certain importance has been placed on food. The food has been analyzed unto, I don't know. Every aspect of food has been analyzed in ancient texts, like the medicinal value of food. There's a whole Ayurveda that is tells you how you should live your life in terms of what you eat and what it does to your body and how you should treat your body and which good foods you should eat at what stage of your life, what you should eat as you're getting older, what you should eat when you're younger. So, and there are reasons for this, and their reasons are certainly the chemical aspects of food, the medicinal aspects of food are very important. So these traditions have become not set in stone as such, but they're there for you to use because they're very helpful. For example, beans and split peas. They say that you eat some when you're young, some you can eat a whole lot when you're in your middle years, and then as you get older, you go back to eating the ones you could eat as when you were young. I think mainly because they're easy to digest. So all this has been worked out for various reasons, and it's been woven into the structure of daily life. It's not imposed from the outside. It's woven into the structure of how you live from morning till night.
They say New Orleanians start planning the rest of their eating at breakfast. You know, folks, they, you know, what are you going to have for mid-meal snack? What are you going to have for lunch? You know,
my husband's American, but, you know, our kids have all grown up and gone, and so he has his studio, and the next room is my studio where I work, and we meet in the hall every now and then. We're busy working, then we come out and meet in the hall. So what are we going to have for lunch? What are we going to have for dinner? Because it's just so important to think about it, and you don't necessarily do anything, but you think about it, and we certainly shop every day, so we want to think what we want that day, and we go to the market, and if whatever looks good, we will buy. And then we'll cook it, and we cook every day. We eat fresh food every day, and we don't actually go out that much because we prefer to eat what we cook at home. And this way, you control every element of it. You control, how much fat or non-fat or the vegetables you need. You don't have to be given a plate of food that you may not necessarily like all parts of it. You can pick and choose exactly what you want to eat.
And I wondered about that. I mean, you're obviously synonymous with Indian cooking, but I'm sure you don't cook Indian food every day. I wondered what you – are there particular cuisines or particular things that you love to cook outside of Indian?
We cook every kind of cuisine. We cook – let's start at one end of the world. We cook Japanese. We cook Chinese. We cook Thai. We cook Indonesian, certainly Malaysian, and we love that. And I mean, I've made Burmese food. Of course, there's Indian. I cook a lot of Middle Eastern stuff. I certainly cook a few Greek things. I cook a lot of Italian food and French food, and so on. I mean, I just love any good food.
I understand your grandkids are all really big cooks.
Grandkids are, who told you that?
I think I read it in an interview or something.
I've just written a piece I write for the Financial Times. I do the odd column for them in England. And I've just written a piece about my grandkids cooking. And my eldest grandkid, who's 14, is making Christmas Eve and Christmas dinner. Completely.
Yeah, I wondered about that because I'm expecting my first child in March. And, you know, of course, I love food. And, you know, it's like you want to raise children with that kind of awareness.
If it's around him or her, they will just absorb it. Because I didn't teach my children. They didn't actually teach their children. It's around them all the time. And if they can taste it, they'll want it. That it just happens. So just keep giving them good things at home, and they'll just learn, and they'll just be cooks.
That makes sense, and that's what I will do.
My grandson is making, I have to tell you, on Christmas Eve, he's making a duck with figs. And on Christmas Day, he's making it's a French rack of lamb with parsley. You know, he's making that.
That's incredible.
And, I know, it is. We're just so impressed with what he's doing, and he just loves it. They all love it, all three of them. Just love to cook. I have three grandkids, and it's a passion. They like other things. I mean, they like taekwondo and, you know, tai chi and ballet and all the rest of it. But they also love to cook.
I didn't know if this was true, but I was curious if it was. I had read somewhere that you were responsible for introducing James Ivory and Ismail Merchant. Is that really?
Yes. That's quite true. We met Ismail, I think, first. I can't remember who we met first. It was either Jim or Ismail. But met them separately. And started working or talking about work with each one of them separately. and then said they should meet each other. And that's how it all started.
So you launched the movie empire, so to speak.
Exactly, exactly.
It's great to be a citizen of history.
what a nice phrase.
And speaking of that as well, I know you spent some time with James Beard early on.
Yes, he started me out.
I wonder what he was like, you know, obviously of being a generation removed.
It'll come to me. But the idea was that we are really performers. And he was an opera singer. He was a frustrated opera singer.
Mm-hmm.
He loved the theater. And he says that's what we both are doing. And we were. We were both theater people, and we were performing as chefs or cooks. Or, you know, we have it in us. I still have it in us.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're so desperate to get across to the people you're teaching. You want them to understand what you're doing, and it's a desire to communicate, and that, oh, hucksters, I think that's the word he used. That's what we are. We are all hucksters. We are all selling something.
which is true.
And he was there, you know, when nobody was signing up for my classes. I just started, and Judy Jones, who was my editor at Knopf, was his editor, too, and she said, you should teach to me, and I said, well, okay. But nobody signed up for my class. So Jim said, okay, you do the class in my house, and we'll get a few people. Don't worry. And so, you know, we actually begged a few people to come to my very first class, which was held in Jim's kitchen. And he lived just a few blocks from me, and then he eventually moved to my block. So as he got older, I was still teaching at his place, and he was getting ill. And he had an apartment upstairs, not apartment, he had a room. It was one brownstone. And he had a room upstairs, and I taught on the lower floor. And when he was ill, he was lying in bed upstairs. And there was a winding staircase that went up to his floor, and he could smell everything. So he would call down and say, could you send me a little bit of whatever, this, whatever I was cooking. And then he would eat that, and he would say again, you'd hear his voice, could you send me a little bit of that? And then we would send it up on little plates for him.
How wonderful. You know, if you knew it was going to be your last meal, what do you think you would want to eat?
I actually wrote a piece on this. I wrote it for Village Voice.
Okay.
They asked the same question. What I said was that it has to be something that slithers down easily. And that it would probably be noodles in some form. They could be from anywhere. They could be from Japan or China or Malaysia or India or Italy. But they'd be some nice, soft noodles.
Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed the interview. As always, drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com if you have any feedback. I hope your holiday celebrations are overfilled with food and lots of drink. And in the meantime, stay hungry.